Tēnā koutou nō mai, haere mai. Welcome to Q&A. I'm Jack Tame. Today, we're cruising on the Inter-Islander, and the waters are getting kind of choppy.
We still don't know the cost to break the contract. I've heard some astronomical monies in US dollars.
Then, the woman who took cars out of the most famous intersection in the world.
There's always that universal objection, you know? And they even used it in New York City. It's like, why are you doing this? We're not Amsterdam, we're not Copenhagen.
We will have that interview for you shortly. But first today, the new Minister of Transport has moved to stop or reverse changes to speed limits around the country that were first put forward as part of the previous government's Road to Zero campaign. It'll mean schools have variable speed limits around pick-up and drop-off times. Simeon Brown is the new Minister of Transport. Good morning, congratulations on your appointment.
Good morning, Jack.
What is the potential downside to changing speed limits outside schools?
Well, what we want to have is the ability for people to get where they need to go quickly and safely. One of the key areas, though, that we need to ensure that there is safety is for young children arriving or being picked up at schools. And so we're not going to continue the last government's blanket approach to reducing speed limits. Mm. We have targeted interventions. And as part of that, we'll require schools to have a slower speed limit at those times of pickup and drop-off, which a lot of other countries do as well.
So what are the potential downsides to having variable speed limits outside schools?
Well, ultimately, it's focused, it's a targeted approach. It's about actually saying, I don't think there's any downsides.
So there's zero downsides whatsoever.
I think it's about making sure we are improving the safety at the time when children are being picked up or dropped off outside schools. And this is about ensuring that the traffic's moving slower and there's improved safety at those times. But actually, the rest of the time, people need to get where they need to go. And so we don't want to take a blanketed approach like the last government where there's whole swathes of Auckland are now 30 kilometres per hour. And if you go visit those suburbs, I tell you what, not many people, including the buses sometimes, are actually doing 30 kilometres per hour.
So just to be clear, as Transport Minister, you think there are zero downsides to having variable speed limits outside schools?
Well,
that's my question.
Well, I think it's about the balanced approach that we need in this circumstances.
So my question is there a downside to having variable speed limits outside schools as opposed to a blanket approach?
Well, the other option is you have to have a blanket reduction in speed limits. One of the issues there is if you go to some of those...
Is there a potential downside to having variable speed limits outside schools?
The issue you've got is where you do go to those suburbs which have got the 30 kilometre per hour blanket speed limit reductions, very few of the cars you actually observe are going at that speed limit. And so you're not actually getting the behaviour change that may have been intended. So we need to take a balanced approach which understands the need for people to get where they need to go, but particularly around those times when children have been picked up or dropped off at school, we want to improve the safety.
Well, sometimes kids go to school early, sometimes they stay late.
And that's why it'll be 8 to 9.30 in the morning, 2.30 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's a reasonable, balanced approach that we want to take to this.
So what sort of productivity gains are you getting from introducing those variable speed limits, specifically outside of schools?
Well, what we're doing is we're not simply just slowing the entirety of the network down, which is what the last government's approach has been to traffic. It's been about slowing people down. You've had blanket speed limit, 30 kilometre per hour speed limit reductions. You've had arterial roads being slowed down. They wanted to slow the entire state highway network.
My question is what productivity gains?
Yeah, I get it. Network down to 80 kilometres per hour. There is increased travel times when you reduce speed limits. Mm. Now, it depends on the actual circumstances of where you might put that particular blanket approach. But we're saying is we want to keep traffic moving at reasonable speeds. But make sure that during those pick-up and drop-off times, we are keeping... And look, I mean, Jack, the last government... I mean, Chris Hipkins even said that he was going to throw the last government.
You're the government.
He was going to chuck it on the bonfire. That's what he thought of this.
You're in government now.
We're making the changes New Zealanders
so,
voted for.
So, Minister, Auckland Transport tested how much time was lost for journeys in urban areas with lower speed limits outside schools. Have you seen that research?
Yeah, so there's been a range of estimates.
So what did Auckland Transport find for the changes outside schools?
Well, it depends on which particular zone.
So over 20 minutes, they started over 20 minutes for 20-minute average journeys. How much time was saved by having the higher speed limits outside schools?
Well, it depends on which school zone you might put it on.
So what did Auckland Transport find?
Well, it'd be a range. So it could have been 20 seconds, could have been a minute.
So they found over a 20-minute... Yeah, they found on average, this is their...
There's a range on these things.
Yeah, so they found...
Depends on the context of the streets. And
they found... Over a 20 minute average trip, it saved on average 15 seconds.
And you've got to add that up across the cumulative number of journeys that are being taken by Aucklanders every single day. Mm. And what we're saying is if you're going past a school when children are being picked up or dropped off at the start of the day, at the end of the day, there will be a slower journey time past those schools. But through the rest of the day, we're not going to take a blanket approach to this. And as I said earlier, You go to those parts of Auckland which have had the 30 kilometres per hour blanket approaches put in place, and you don't see many people following that because it's not reasonable. So we need to take a balanced approach, and then make sure where you do have those slower speed limits during pick-up and drop-off times, you then enforce it.
Okay. You've published a new draft transport GPS. So in what ways would you say that it most significantly changes the transport modal balance from the previous government's plans?
Well, we're focused on improving economic growth and productivity, something which wasn't part of the previous government's draft transport policy statement. We wanted to bring back the Roads of National Significance, which was a successful program to unlock economic growth in this country by building high-quality roading infrastructure between our cities and between our regions. But there's also an investment that we're making into reliable public transport, building on the investment the last national government did in the City Rail Link, electrifying the rail network here in Auckland. We want to build on that through rapid bus transit, and that's the direction of travel we're taking.
So walking and cycling funding has halved, right? So in terms of a modal shift, you've changed the shift.
Well, there's actually, if you look at Phil Twyford's final GPS back in 2021, our upper limit for walking and cycling is actually higher.
Right, than what I'm going to the one that was in place last year.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's less than that. That's absolutely.
Good. So when you were here during the election campaign, I asked you about the accuracy of your transport costings, and I asked repeatedly if you'd accounted for inflation. And you brushed aside those concerns at the time. You said you'd taken an economically prudent approach to costings with the information you had available. So when NZTA costed your project in November, did they find that your party's costings were accurate?
Well, there is a range of estimates that they provided in terms of what those...
What do they find about
But when we took... What we took to the election was the most recent up-to-date information, as I said when I was here. But we've also made it very clear that we're going to need a range of funding and financing tools in order to deliver the infrastructure.
Sorry, that's not my question.
And we spoke about this last time here as well. We need to look at a whole range of ways to fund and finance the infrastructure New Zealand
needs. Question was, despite all of the concerns that were raised during the election campaign, and the scrutiny that was put over your costings, and the questions about properly accounting for inflation, when NZTA costed your projects, did they find your costings were accurate?
Well, they presented a range of what those costings would be.
And did they find that your costings were accurate?
Well, there was a range of estimates for each of those different projects.
And did their range find that your range was accurate?
Well, the reality is there has been cost increases in transport infrastructure, and part of that is because there's been scope increase. Part of that's because it's taking longer and harder to consent things in New Zealand. The consent conditions that are being imposed are adding significant cost. And that's why, as a government, we're going through all of those issues to actually say, if we're going to be able to build and deliver the infrastructure New Zealand needs, whether that's public transport or whether that's roading, we actually need to get it back to what is the core purpose of that infrastructure that we're trying to do. And I'll give you an example.
This is very important. I understand what you're trying to do. I've got a question here. There was a lot of scrutiny on those costings. A lot of people said you haven't properly accounted for inflation, the consenting issues that you have raised. You said, no, we're the party of fiscal discipline, we're the party of economic prudence. We've got this right. So if you just take the average range from NZTA's costings versus the ones you took to the election, how inaccurate were you?
Well, as I said, there's a range of estimates within...
So take the average.
Well, the reality is there's been a range of estimates, and what they've made very clear, though...
So what was the average? How inaccurate were you by the average?
Well, I'll put it this way. There is a number of things that I've been presented advice over which has been causing significant cost increases and which we as a government are focused on dealing with. And so consent conditions, and I use an example of a consent condition which I think is absurd. There is a seawall being built between Petone and Wellington where one of the consent conditions is for the New Zealand Transport Agency to build underwater sea pyramids as part of that. Now, that doesn't do anything to help build the seawall, but they're required to spend huge amounts of money on things like that. Mount Messenger, NZTA has been required to spend $750,000 in perpetuity on pest control and thousands of hectares of land they don't own around that project. We want to go through, and that's why one-stop-shop fast-track consents is so critical to reducing costs so that we are paying for what we need as a country, as well as the innovative funding and financing opportunities we need to get things done.
So again, I'm just going to go back to that question. Using the average cost, the average forecasting that NZTA applied compared to your costings, how many billions of dollars short were you?
Well, we've always said we're going to need a range of funding and financing tools to be able to deliver the infrastructure
Minister, that's not the question.
We've been very open about that.
Here's an opportunity to be open. How many billions of dollars short were you by your costings in the election campaign, taking the average?
Well, what we've said is we need a range of funding and financing opportunities.
You're
to
not
build
being
these
open
projects,
and accurate. Sorry, Minister.
And we're going to go through
Minister,
the scope
sorry.
Of these projects, but we're committed to delivering
How many billions of dollars short were you?
In terms of the...
The average costing.
Well, there's a range of estimates that were provided.
That's why we're going with the average. And, the average range.
And the average range...
How many billions
well,
short?
I mean, to be honest, I think this conversation is driving at the wrong element. What we're focused on is delivery. We're focused on reducing
How many billions
costs
of dollars short were you?
And we're focused on getting things done as
how
a government.
How many billions of dollars short?
Well, I think the estimate that we took to the election was around 24. The lower range of what the NZTA has suggested based on a bunch of assumptions was around $30 billion. But as I've
said... So that's if you take that's $6 billion short. But if you take the average, it's about $16 billion short.
Well, as I've always said, though, we have always said we need to have new ways of funding and financing infrastructure in New Zealand. And that means whether it's public-private partnerships, whether it's build-own-operate transfer, whether it's having... increased use of tolling to actually fund this infrastructure. If you read my draft GPS, we have said as a government that we will, as a government, accept any recommendation to toll any new roads because we need to make sure we have a user pays approach to building the infrastructure. And by doing so, we get that investment brought forward because the alternative is we don't do anything. The alternative, Jack, is we don't do anything as a country. Nothing gets built and we don't reap the economic benefits that this country needs. And there's a report put together
I've got to ask a question.
Well, there was a report
lots of reports. You promised no new taxes going into the election. How much vehicle registration fees increasing?
So we're going to increase the National Land Transport Fund component of the motor vehicle registration fee by $25 on the 1st of January next year.
Did you campaign on that?
And another $25. No, we didn't.
Right.
But ultimately, what we've put together is a GPS, which is focused on funding the transport system. It has a significant increase in making sure we reduce the number of potholes and improve and the resilience and maintenance of our network. But we have delivered in this draft GPS and our commitment not to increase fuel excise this year, next year, or in 2026.
It's 2027, it goes up. Page 15 of the GPS. Investment in walking and cycling should only take place where there is either clear benefit for increasing economic growth or clear benefit for improving safety and demonstrated volumes of pedestrians and cyclists already exist. So does that mean that we have to wait for a road to have lots of cyclists using it and potentially risking their lives before we support a bike lane?
No, what we're saying here is I think a lot of New Zealanders have seen a lot of these very expensive cycleways being built, some of them costing tens of millions of dollars for relatively low patronage or number of cyclists using them.
There has to be an economic benefit.
So we want to see efficiency from that spend. So there's a range of $70 to $130 million per year in the range. What we're saying is we want to see good value for money and we want to see good benefit from that use. So that's the purpose of having some constraints added to that activity class.
So does that same rule regarding the return on investment apply for the roads of national significance?
Well, look, we'll absolutely be looking at all of those benefits as well.
Yeah, does it apply? Because there has to be a clear benefit if you
absolutely. Well, there will have to be clear benefit from those roads as well.
So have you initiated business cases for all of the roads of national significance?
They have not all started. I mean, you've got to remember the last six years, the government turned off the roads of national significance program. And so we're having to turn that back on. They basically stopped building roads because they didn't believe in them. We know that roads are critically important to growing our economy, improving productivity and improving safety.
So
there's a huge amount of work that the New Zealand Transport Agency is now going to start again so we can get this program underway.
So will all of those roads of national significance have to have a benefit-cost ratio of at least one in order to go ahead?
Well, the agency will go through that process, but I mean... favourite one that you like to raise is the East-West Link and the advice... that was provided to the select committee by the New Zealand Transport Agency just a couple of months ago, it has a BCR of 1.9.
Great. So will all roads of national significance...
Well, they'll absolutely be going through that process.
But my question is, will you still support them if they don't have a benefit-cost ratio of at least one?
Well, we'll be going through that business process. We'll be taking into account the wider economic benefits. If you look at Cambridge to Piarere, every year that's not constructed... Yeah. Not only is that an unsafe road that New Zealanders are travelling on,
but
we're losing $500 million of GDP and according to a recent report by NZIER. So we need to get on and get things done in this country.
Sure, but I mean, there's no point in getting things done if we're not going to get value for money. That's the whole driving ethos behind your GPS, right?
And I just give you that example of Cambridge to Piarere, which people say, oh, no, it's a low-value piece of infrastructure.
Sure.
Well, it's $500 million of economic benefit we are not receiving because the last government cancelled
that road.
And so
my question is...
And a very dangerous alternative
that people
have to use.
My question is, will you commit to only building roads of national significance that the evidence shows will give us value for money by returning a business cost ratio of over one?
We'll absolutely be making sure they return value for money for taxpayers. But also, I'll put it this way. But also put it this way. We're going to give the... We're going to require that all new roads of national significance, where there is a recommendation to toll them, will be tolled to help maintain them and to pay for the capital cost, because we believe in user pays, and we want to make sure that that is a key part of delivering this infrastructure. And I'd also put it out, point out too, for those parts of New Zealand where we haven't necessarily put roads of national significance, by making sure that the ones which are tolled are tolled, we maintain our maintenance budgets so that we're able to look after our rural and regional state highways to a better standard as well.
The GPS has pulled money from public transport, although public transport patronage data shows that it's almost back up to pre-COVID levels now. Is it your expectation that it will ultimately result in a reduction of public transport services?
No, not at all. This is about making sure that there's a balance between how much different parts of the transport system are paying. Private share has reduced from about 40% of the funding to about 13%, and so we want to get the balance right. From the data that I've been given from the New Zealand Transport Agency, last year they provided about $500 million in NZTA share towards public transport operations in the country. And I point that out because the range that we've provided in the GPS is between $400 and $700 million.
Right.
So we have a range which will adequately support the public transport services that New Zealand
has. But again, the funding is cut relative to the previous GPS, the previous government's GPS.
Previous government's draft GPS.
Yes. So If your government won't make up that shortfall, and I appreciate there's a range...
I'm just saying there's not a shortfall because the current financial year, NZTA is providing around $500 million. The range we've provided is $400 to $700 million. What they will be spending is well within the range.
In order to continue services as they are today, either councils will have to further fund those or we should expect public transport fares to increase.
Well, ultimately, we've provided a range which we believe will provide that reliable service that New Zealanders need.
There's there today. Nothing's going to change. We're not going to see public transport fares increase.
Well, as I said, this year it's $500 million from what I've been told. The range is $400 to $700 million. So there's actually room for growth.
Okay.
But I'd also point out, you know, councils do have to make sure they're getting the private share up. You know, there's multiple ways they can do that. Increased patronage, fare box, also advertising. They need to do a better job.
Congestion charging?
Yes.
Everyone seems to agree on it. Are we going to see it this term?
Absolutely. It's part of one of our coalition agreements.
It will be in place this term?
Well, we're moving at pace around getting the legislation ready for that.
And you think on the balance of likelihood, appreciating that stuff takes a long time to actually get through
Parliament? Well, ultimately, there's two steps. Firstly, we need to pass legislation. We're working at pace around preparing that. The second step is then those councils which wish to implement it need to go through a process to implement it as well. So I'm talking with the Mayor of Auckland about this. He's obviously very interested. We want to make sure this is about giving, you know, people who pay a congestion charge get something for it, which is a shorter journey time, a more reliable journey time. That's going to be the key focus of it.
Very good. Okay. After the break, one of the government's first moves in office was to scrap Three Waters. So what's going to take its place? Hawke Mai, welcome back. Three Waters is dead, nixed as part of the coalition government's 100-day plan. So what comes next? Simeon Brown is the Minister for Local Government. What are the next steps in introducing a replacement for Three Waters?
Well, as you said, we've repealed the last government's co-governed mega-entity approach, which many councils across the country rejected. We're now implementing what we call Local Water Done Well, which is about providing councils the ability to have financial sustainable approaches to water infrastructure. I don't think anyone's denying the fact that we need to have a more financially sustainable approach to water infrastructure in New Zealand. We've got huge challenges ahead of us. We want to have the funding and the funding tools available for local government to be able to make those decisions and make those long-term investments they need to do.
Okay, three very simple yes or no's. Number one, will your government put any new money in to support councils get their water up to scratch?
Well, we're focused on making sure they've got the funding and financing tools to be able
yes
to do
no.
that. So
is there going to be any new money?
Well, we're not putting capital in. The last government didn't
either. Yeah. Number two, will you give councils any new money in order to establish the CCO entities?
Well, we're working through some options around some of that, but I can't.
But that's a possibility, it's something you're considering.
Well, ultimately, there is some money remaining from the last government reforms. Yep. We're looking at some options around that, but I can't give any answers right here.
And will the government underwrite the debt of those CCOs in the future?
No, that's not our intent. We've made that very clear through this process.
Do you accept that rates will have to significantly increase in order to deliver services that meet the regulatory requirements as they stand?
No, because ultimately what we're focused on here is giving councils the long-term funding and financing tools that they need. And there's a range of options that could work. For some councils, I mean, I met with, you know, Ron Mark, who's the mayor of Carterton yesterday, and he said, look, we're good till the 2040s in terms of we've made prudent decisions, we've invested, and we're in a really good position.
What about Tararua, just up the road?
Well, exactly. Other councils are in a more challenging circumstance. So we're going to require councils. So we've got legislation coming to Parliament in the middle of this year, which will require councils to put forward a water service delivery plan, which will show over the next 10 years, 30 years, what their plans are and how they intend to have a financially sustainable approach to it. Now, some councils might join together in a regional CCO to do that. Others might want to work with the local government funding agency to see how they can have borrowing which is tied to their water revenues. We're going to make sure that all water revenue is ring-fenced to go back into water. But there'll be a range of ways that councils will approach that financially sustainable model.
So how do we know that when councils are preparing those plans, especially the councils that are in more dire positions at the moment, won't just say, yep, well, we can meet all these requirements, but we have to significantly increase rates?
Yeah, well, we're going to have three tests for it.
That's a possibility.
So one will be we want to make sure the money's ring-fenced, make sure it's sufficient and affordable. And the third one is actually the funding for growth. And so they will have to start, you know, a number of councils, and they're already talking about how they can have a regional council-controlled organisation which gets that scale, means it's an affordable, you spread the cost of that infrastructure over a longer period of time. You have a user-pays approach, which means
the question is whether or not some councils, depending on the state of their water infrastructure, will have to really massively increase rates and forecast those increases in rates in order to achieve what you are requiring them to achieve under their long-term plans.
Well, ultimately, they'll be working with other councils around that as well.
Some of them will be, right?
And we'll have a regulatory backstop. So if they're unable or unwilling in terms of putting forward that plan, which meets those tests... we will have a regulatory backstop, which will allow the government to step in.
So Simon Watts appeared on the show last year once you first introduced your Three Waters alternative plan. Here's what he had to say in February 2023.
What will your plan do to the cost of water bills and for rates?
So our view is that it's definitely going to, under our model, rates are not going to increase. Are not going to increase in comparison to Labor's Three Waters model and the status quo.
So for the record, this parliamentary term, will water costs for ratepayers be higher than they would have been under the previous government's plan?
Well, the councils are going through their long-term planning process at the moment, as you know, and they are facing significant challenges. We're facing significant challenges as well through with its increased cost of infrastructure, interest rates,
Answer this question, please. Yep. So will water costs for ratepayers this term be higher than they would have been under the previous government's plan?
Well, the previous government's reforms weren't going to come into effect until 2026.
That's why I ask.
For the vast majority of councils. So the reality is we're actually working at pace. Here we're going to have our reforms fully legislated by middle of 2025.
Again, that doesn't answer the question. Will water costs for ratepayers this term potentially be higher than they would have been under the previous government's plan?
Well, what we're doing
it's a really straight question. Please just answer that question.
Well, we're very focused on making sure we have an affordable approach, providing councils the ability to make
I'm going to ask it one more time. Will water costs for ratepayers this term, as your previous spokesperson promised, will they this term potentially be higher than they would have been under the previous government's plans?
No, they won't be. And the reality is, I'd say, is we are focused on giving the long-term funding and financing tools to local government so they can make those investments. And you know, if you think about the Infrastructure Funding and Financing Act, whether that's having off-balance sheet special purpose vehicles to make those investments and spread that cost over a longer period of time, we're very focused on providing a range of funding and financing tools to help councils make those investments and also ensure that cost is spread over a longer period of time to keep the cost down for ratepayers.
And that they have economies of scale, right?
Well, and that's through the CCO model.
Models, basically, where councils can come together to try and achieve economies of scale. So why would a big council with good infrastructure join together and effectively subsidise a council that has crappy water infrastructure?
Well, the reality is we're going to ask all councils to work together
Just to be clear, are you going to mandate that?
Well, they will be putting forward their plans for water service delivery plans.
Councils have a statutory requirement, right, to act in the interest of their ratepayers. You agree with that, right?
Yes, they do.
So why would a big council with really good water infrastructure want to join up with another small council that doesn't?
Because ultimately, even if you think of Tauranga and Hamilton, right, they're going to need to even get economies of scale if they were to work together. They're going to need to find economies of scale. That means actually having enough people and enough users within that scheme to be able to achieve that.
And so let's look at the South Island West Coast.
I've been around the country this week. Mm. I've met with mayors in the South Island, Lower North Island, East Coast. All of the mayors are very focused on how they're going to work together to solve this problem.
So here's what the mayor of Buller, Jamie Klein, told the press. He said that West Coast mayors had considered joining up to make effectively a CCO under the previous government's plans, but found no advantage or economies of scale. Quote, "We would need to approach Canterbury or Tasman mayors. I'm absolutely open to that, but I'm cognizant we would be bringing an unpalatable business case to the table." So my question is, if councils don't join together, will your government mandate they do so?
Well, I say we will have a regulatory backstop.
Does that mean mandating them to work together?
It could mean that we will have step-in powers like we do under the Local Government Act, where under the Local Government Act, the minister can appoint a commissioner. So there will be step-in powers.
Would that be mandating, though? So take that West Coast example, would you say, Canterbury, you've got to pick up the bill for the West Coast? Well, it would be effectively
to require those councils to work together.
Right.
And so we don't want to see councils left behind.
Yeah.
But we also want to see councils take responsibility for these conversations. Sure. And so I don't want
to... You don't want to have to use
a regulatory step-in power. It'll be a similar intervention to when electricity reforms were done in the 90s, where there were step-in powers put in place then. They were never used.
Yeah. It's not really local water done well, though, is it? It's not really local if you're mandating councils against their will.
It's a backstop. It's a backstop to ensure that we can ensure that we have a financially sustainable approach. But ultimately, it leaves these assets in councils' hands, which is what they've been asking for. And we're giving them the ability to put forward their plans to make those long-term investments. Mm.
Balance sheet separation, this accounting term that gets thrown around the whole time with this conversation, the ability of the new CCOs to effectively separate their balance sheets from councils. So under your model, will you guarantee that all councils and CCOs in New Zealand will achieve balance sheet separation?
Well, I just pointed out that's one way to achieve financial sustainability for water infrastructure. I mean, if you think about some councils which have done a really good job, they may well be able to manage those costs within the existing framework. So that's one tool. The other tool is putting together a regional CCO, which is then able to use to leverage the revenues to be able to borrow against those revenues and make those investments without necessarily requiring balance sheet separation.
Right.
In some instances, particularly here in Auckland, that financial separation will be critical because it can't partner with other councils in order to do that.
So I just want to know, under your legislation, will you guarantee that all new CCOs will have the ability to achieve balance sheet separation?
Well, we're going to provide the ability through legislation for that to be an option, but it's not necessarily going to be necessary because there'll be a range of different ways in which councils...
Will it be achievable? Will you guarantee that it will be achievable for CCOs?
What we want to make achievable is financial sustainability.
I get that, but my focus is balance sheet separation.
So just give us a straight answer on that.
Will you guarantee that all new CCOs will be able to achieve balance sheet separation under your legislation?
Well, the second piece of legislation we'll be bringing to the House at the end of this year will make changes around the council-controlled organisation legislative framework model in order for that financial separation to happen. So whether that's requiring no guarantees from councils...
But you won't make that guarantee this morning, though, that they can all get balance sheet separation.
That's the intention of the second piece of legislation that we're bringing to Parliament later this year. At the moment, we're working very closely with Auckland, in particular regarding water care, to ensure we get that for Auckland Council. So that's where we're at the moment. And the piece of legislation we bring at the end of this year, we focused on that model and making sure that
it can achieve that. You won't make that guarantee this morning.
Well, we want to have a model which can achieve that. But I'm just saying...
You want, but I'm asking guarantees.
What I say is the financial sustainability doesn't necessarily require that because there are other... The local government funding agency...
I appreciate you're saying it might not be necessary. I get that. I'm asking, nonetheless, if your legislation will guarantee that all of them will do it.
Correct.
Okay. Are the drinking water standards required under Taumata Arawaitu onerous?
Well, when we were in opposition, we did make the point around the rural drinking suppliers. There's a large number of very small rural drinking suppliers which The regulatory burden is quite significant, so we will look at that. But ultimately, we are committed to high-quality water infrastructure. Mm. We want to make sure it's over a time frame which is deliverable and achievable. But we are committed to high-quality water for New Zealanders, which is safe to drink.
You are considering sharing GST with councils on new developments. To be clear, would councils have to wait for a development to be completed before getting the share of GST?
Well, that's a piece of work that my colleague Chris Bishop's focused on in terms of the options that we've got around that. That's a coalition commitment with the ACT Party to explore a revenue sharing type arrangement. The details have been worked through. We don't have any particular answers around what that would look like right now. But we are committed to working with councils to support those councils which are achieving above historical levels of housing development so we can incentivise growth in New Zealand.
Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Minister for Local Government, Simeon Brown. If you want to contact the Q&A team, please call Ed or Mai. These are our main platforms. You can flick us an email. You can find us on X or on Facebook. Up next on Q&A, we're sailing to the other side. The government might have hit pause on the Cook Strait crossing replacement. So what's going to happen next? Kia ora, welcome back to Q&A. It's 3 months since Finance Minister Nicola Willis pulled the plug on the Cook Strait ferry project after massive cost blowouts. While it's now back to square one, there is a big job ahead in unravelling work already done. Here's reporter Fiona Owen.
Here we go. Wellington to Picton, the watery bit of State Highway 1.
The Inter-Island of Ferries have a certain charm. But crossing the strait was about to become another experience altogether.
We're looking for engineers, project managers, planners.
With the IREX project scrapped, that's two new ships, two new terminals, everyone's looking for a plan B. And we're back with the fleet of ageing ferries.
So around 14 months ago, this ship, the Kaitaki, lost power in Cook Strait with 880 people on board. It was drifting toward the rocky coastline and issued a Mayday call.
It was so scary.
Cook Strait is an angry, treacherous piece of water.
Marlborough District Council Mayor Nadine Taylor.
Having those new boats adding to the resilience, we wouldn't be seeing any more breakdowns. We knew they had superior navigation, superior safety, so we were looking forward to this project racing ahead.
All passengers with vehicles to proceed to the vehicle decks and prepare to drive ashore.
Portside on the South Island, passengers arriving and departing have to navigate around closed and temporary terminals and a maze of abandoned construction.
Here in Picton, the locals are reminded every day of the beginnings of the IREX project with all the street closures around town. Here they were going to build a road overbridge.
We're wanting to know when the roads can be reopened again so we can become a complete town. At the moment we're completely cut in half.
It's very poor with only having one level crossing to go across with all the backlog of trains and people. If there's a fire or an ambulance, they just can't get across.
The roadworks that have the town severed, we have to get the town back to functioning the way it was before IREX.
And they've told us they really want that back. They want their streets back.
I can completely understand that. Actually, it's a town that I live in. I want those streets back too. So we're working at pace to try and get that done. I understand that we'll be able to get partway by the end of April, full opening. We're aiming for sort of June, July.
That's where the terminal was meant to be built.
On the Wellington side, work was not so advanced, but some costly construction material has already been bought, as National Secretary of the Maritime Union, Craig Harrison, points out.
So what do they do with that steel now?
Well, it'll probably go to, whether it gets on-sold or scrapped, it'll be probably a discount deal at some auction somewhere.
KiwiRail has spent at least $424 million on the CAND project, but that's not including the cost of breaking contracts with the ship builder.
We still don't know the cost to break the contract. I've heard some astronomical monies in US dollars to break contracts
like
out
what?
Of ships.
Like what?
Maybe $200 million US to break the contract. We've been told through contacts in different places that there's already parts in the shipyards for the ships already. So to break those contracts, the main contractor, Hyundai, will be going to subcontractors and there'll be penalty clauses.
How much is it going to cost to terminate the contracts with the shipbuilders?
Well, there's a commercial negotiation taking place, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to speculate on that.
Surely you have some indication at this stage, though, from Kiwi Rail, how much that is going to cost?
Given it's a commercial matter, I would be putting taxpayers at risk if I was to speculate on that.
We feel like we're in a bit of limbo. People don't know what's going to happen.
Back in Picton, Pete Coldwell, who heads the Marlborough Chamber of Commerce, acknowledges that many in the area could see the IREX project needed scaling down, but the complete scrapping of it, he says, reflects an Auckland-centric blind spot toward the South Island.
I think there's one South Island MP in the Cabinet, and it does feel like we've not got many voices shouting and championing and advocating for the South Island at the moment. At the end of the day, as we see the Cook Strait ferries coming in there, this is the state highway. This is a crucial part of our infrastructure.
For over 60 years, it's also been part of the main trunk line. Right now, the Arateri takes rail. On the other ferries, rail freight is moved onto trailers for the crossing.
A load could go potentially from Auckland right down to Invercargill without actually coming off the wagon. And so it's much more efficient and it's actually safer. Most countries are gearing up to have more rail.
The IREX ferries had increased capacity for continuous rail. Now there's doubt whether any replacement ferries, new or second-hand, will be rail-enabled.
I would still expect freight from rail to go on the ferries.
But not necessarily roll-on, not necessarily trains on those, or in other words, rail-enabled?
No. We believe that we can still have freight on the ferries without them necessarily being rail-enabled.
Separating the North and South Island and not being able to have rolling stock and trains moving across the Strait and back again would just be a really poor decision.
This week, an OIA requested by Business Desk revealed that in briefing notes, the Ministry of Transport has questioned whether Kiwi Rail is best placed to run the ferries.
Kiwi Rail can do it. Kiwi Rail's been doing the ships for a long, long time. They're good at what they do.
They have not indicated to me that they're keen to stop delivering ferry services.
Kiwi Rail indicated to Q&A that they will continue to focus on providing the service and working with the government on Plan B.
So on the homeward stretch, Picton to Wellington, this time on the Kaiārahi. We couldn't have taken the ship last week because it was out of service. They had a problem with the lifeboat mechanism, but all fixed now.
And from here, it's the big fix the country will be looking out for now.
Ah, the Strait looks like a mill pond, doesn't it? Fiona Owen reporting there. After the break, if you can change the street, you can change the world. That's the message from one of the world's best known transport and urban planners. But come on, how do our cities really compare to New York? Kia ora koutou, welcome back to Q&A. Bike lanes, public transport and roads. If you thought the debate over transport policy in New Zealand was fraught, you can only imagine the kinds of pressures at play in one of the world's busiest cities. Janet Sadiq Khan is New York's former transport commissioner and is currently working for Bloomberg Philanthropies. She headed the expansion of cycling networks in the city and famously pedestrianised a large part of Times Square. I sat down with her on Friday.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but New Zealand now has the highest level of car ownership per capita in the entire world. So welcome.
Well, thank you. That's not an honour that people are aspiring to these days.
Give us a big picture perspective, if you can, to kick things off. Globally, to what extent are cities changing from car-centric designs?
You're seeing a huge movement in cities that are moving from car-centric design to people-focused design, literally flipping the script of the street. And instead of having cars at the top of the mobility hierarchy, you're putting people at the top. And you're seeing this in city after city. World-class cities are prioritizing walking and biking and public transport because they're better for everyone. They're safer ways of getting around. They're more cost-effective ways of getting around. They improve the livability and the economic development of a city. And so you really can't afford not to be making these investments for a 21st century city.
Is it a luxury afforded only to wealthy countries, though?
These kinds of changes are incredibly inexpensive. You know, in New York, we got a lot of criticism. We had closed Times Square to cars and opened it to people. We built 650 kilometers of bike lanes, 70 plazas, 7 rapid bus lines, all under Mike Bloomberg in 6 years. People were like, you're spending all this money. That money was less than 1% of our capital budget. 99% was spent on improving our road and bridge infrastructure. But even though that was 1% of the budget, it got 99% of the headlines because we were changing the status quo.
Yeah. Can you give us a bit more of the New York story? Let's start off with the decision to pedestrianize parts of Times Square.
Well, it was a great moment. You know, I do remember going to City Hall and presenting it to Mike Bloomberg, and he had all of his deputy mayors around the table, and he asked each of them what they thought of this idea. And person after person after person, let's just say, didn't think it was a great idea, particularly since it was right before his reelection. And so when we were finished, I thought, okay, well, that's too bad. It would have been a great idea. But the mayor turned to me and he said, you know, I don't ask my commissioners to do the right thing according to the political calendar. I ask my commissioners to do the right thing, period. Mm. And so he shook my hand and he said, let's do it. And what let's do it meant was basically closing Broadway from 42nd to 47th Street. You know, you've been to New York City and Manhattan is on a grid, right? And Broadway is the only street that cuts through. And so it does great things, there are great plazas, but it creates these hot spots of congestion. So the idea was, let's just restore the grid so we could make it actually better for traffic because you're going through two intersections instead of, you know, three intersections. And so we did it. We did it as a pilot. So we were going to measure it and see if it worked. And if it worked, we'd keep it. And if not, we'd put it back. But doing it as a pilot, and this is a really important piece that we've seen other cities use, doing a pilot reduces the anxiety because it's temporary materials, right? Right. It's paint, it's planters, it's stones, right? You can put it back if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So we did it, and it was a huge success. It was much better for business. Retail sales soared. It became one of the top 10 retail locations on the planet, and it was better for people. We had 100,000 more people going through Times Square every day. You probably saw those 100,000 additional people when you were there. But it became this model of how you can move fast to change your streets and change your city.
What did you love about bike lanes?
I think if you want to change your city, there's no better way to start than with a bike lane. And it transforms the street. And it's not just about making a street better for cyclists. When you put down a bike lane, you make a street better for everyone. You can shorten the crossing, which makes it easier for kids to cross the street, for older people to cross the street. You can improve the lanes for drivers. And it's easy to create this new space for cyclists. So the street's safer. It feels better. And when you have more people on the street, people naturally kind of slow down and accommodate everybody. And when you think about it, you know, the great streets, you know, in cities that you see today, what do you love about them? They're filled with people, right? London, Paris, Rome, you know, all these, Barcelona, Bogota, all of these places, Mexico City, they're great cities because they have great streets that are filled with people. And so that's the sort of secret sauce of cities.
You mentioned the opposition you had to the pedestrianization plan in Times Square. What kind of opposition did you have for 650 Ks of bike lanes in New York?
Yeah, it was certainly a street fight, you know. There are 8.4 million New Yorkers, and I started to feel that there were 8.4 million traffic engineers because everybody had a really strong opinion about it. But the interesting thing was, you know, when you move fast and you show what's possible on your streets, right, people are not used to their streets changing. So I understand the anger, right? Because people are used to, this is the way my street has been, and if that's the way it's been, suddenly somebody coming in and changing it is upsetting. It's, you know, you're concerned about it, you're fearful about it. But when you can show how the street can change, You know, it's amazing how the proof of the project changes how people feel about the streets. So we had a lot of people that came out and demonstrated. Yeah. Some of my favorite signs were like, don't be conned by Sadakan. You know, I mean, they had like very strong wordplay and a lot of strong feelings about the work. But the interesting piece was after those 650 kilometers of bike lanes were put down and after the bike lash that we went through, the last poll taken by the New York Times at the end of the Bloomberg administration found 73% support for bike share.
Yeah.
You know, 72% support for our plazas and 64% support for our bike lanes. Mm. You know, if bike lanes were running for mayor, they would have been elected. Mm. And that's a very different status quo than it was when we started. And so you can actually change the culture and what people's expectations and experience is of their city.
Okay. I'll put it to you, though, that New York is different to New Zealand in that, first of all, it's very flat. There is a lot of high-density housing. There is an amazing public transport network with a subway that runs 24/7. Is a city like New York uniquely suited to bike lanes in a way that perhaps countries like New Zealand aren't quite as well suited?
It's so funny because there's always that universal objection, you know? And they even used it in New York City. It's like, why are you doing this? We're not Amsterdam. We're not Copenhagen. You know, we're too hot in the summer. We're too cold in the winter. You know, this is not going to work. Or here, it's too hilly. It's too windy. It's too cold. It's always to something, right? But what we've seen in city after city is that it's not to anything. There's no bad, you know, city for cycling. There's just bad infrastructure. And if you build it, they will come.
In your current role, you travel the world and advise mayors around the world on transport design in their cities. What are the most common problems you still see?
Well, I think it's about making choices better for people for how they get around, sort of inviting them to get around the city differently. Because, you know, if you just keep building more and more roads and more lanes, you're just going to get more and more traffic, more and more lanes filled with traffic. I mean, we've learned this lesson. That if you building more lanes to accommodate traffic is like loosening your belt to accommodate obesity, right? It doesn't work. And so you have to bring a different model. We're not going to accommodate the 30% growth that we're going to be seeing here in this city by double-decking our roads, right? By the same token, we're not going to get people onto bikes and buses and walking by wishing them onto them. We have to provide high-quality infrastructure for them to get around, easier ways for them to get around, to invite them to get around differently.
So talk to us a bit more about what you see the priorities for New Zealand as being, or the opportunities perhaps. You've been in Wellington and Auckland. What do you make of New Zealand?
Well, I think it's one of the most beautiful countries I've ever seen. And I feel very fortunate to be here. And actually, it's changed a lot. I was here 10 years ago in 2014 in Auckland. And since then, you know, I was riding bikes around with an amazing group of people yesterday, and we're riding on Key Street, and we're riding on Queen Street, and, you know, we're on K Road, and it's, you know, the light path, you know, the pink path. It was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, that infrastructure was not there 10 years ago. So a lot of progress has been made, and it's exciting to see the kind of investments that are being made on the walking and biking side. And they're the most sustainable economic development strategies you can have. So I think that is the recipe, you know, building more and more of that in the years to come that's going to ensure that Auckland continues to be this bright light on the global map.
Like lots of other places, there is an ongoing debate about where future investment should go into new roads or into new bike lanes, into new public transport. Do you think at the moment New Zealand has the balance right?
I think that you need to be prioritizing transit and walking and biking. And I think you're seeing that in city after city. You can look, Paris is a great example of that right now. I mean, Anne Hidalgo has just doubled down on the cycling network and doubled the public transit investment, and you're seeing huge results. And I think that that's basically what it's about. And these strategies, you know, walking and biking and transit, these aren't just like amenities that are nice to have, right? These are strong economic development strategies, because when you think about it, people can move anywhere these days in this global world, right? And so people are attracted to places where it's easier to get around, where it's more livable, more enjoyable. And I think that's why these kinds of investments are so much more than just nice things to have. They're critical strategies.
From a political perspective then, what would be your advice on overcoming some of the opposition to things like more transit options or pedestrian and bike lane options?
Well, I think you have to keep going, right? I mean, I think that you're seeing other places moving forward faster, right? And so if we want to continue to have the quality of life that we have in Auckland, those are, it's critical that we make those kinds of investments. And they're not expensive, right? You can move fast to change your streets. You can move fast to change your cities. And in fact, there's a cost of just sticking with the status quo.
But is there any advice you would have from your experience in overcoming the political opposition?
I think it's really important to talk about the benefits of these kinds of strategies. Like, safety is a really important backbone for these kinds of this kind of work. And it was the frame that we used in New York City. Every project that we did, we looked at from a safety perspective. We had done this big study which looked at 7,000 traffic crashes and injuries. Like, where did they happen? Who did they happen? When did they happen? All of that. And that drove what we did. And I think that's important here, too. When you think about it, New Zealand has a higher rate of traffic fatalities than we've got in New York City. We have 3 million more people, but we have a third of the traffic fatalities that you have. And that's, you know, that's almost irresponsible. You know, you need to be prioritizing people when you're doing your streets. I was walking, you know, across the street, even just coming over here today, and there's not enough time almost across the street. You practically have to be an Olympic sprinter to get across the street, right? And that's not great. I mean, we're in good shape. But, like, if you're holding the hand of a three-year-old or you're with an older person, it's hard to get across the street in the time that you're given. And so I think...
You mean at the crossing with the lights, right?
At the crossing with the lights. And I think it's important that we... That's part of looking at our streets a little differently. And that frame, that safety frame, making it possible for everyone, not just looking at our infrastructure from the dashboard of a car, is key.
Yeah. What do you think of congestion charging?
I'm very supportive of congestion pricing. We did that and we proposed it under Mike Bloomberg starting in 2007, and now we're looking to implement it this summer. So it's taken a little while for us to get there. Other cities have done a great job of it. You see what Mayor Khan is doing in London with the ultra-low emission zone. You see what Mayor Saul is doing in Milan. You see, you know, so many cities are moving forward because they understand that, you know, it's hard to just keep passing the hat for funding for public transportation, and having dedicated revenue streams is really key. And it's also key because when you think about it, you were in New York City, so you saw how people got around, right? 85% of people in New York City get around by public transit, by walking and biking. But most of the public space is dedicated to the 15% of those who are in cars, and we need to improve the public transport system. And as it currently exists, people can drive into the central business district for free. You know, even people who take transit pay to take the train, but people who drive don't pay anything at all. And so we need to rebalance this, and it's going to make it better for drivers when we actually are being able to move some of those people onto public transit and expand our system. So it's a win-win-win, and we're looking forward to the implementation this summer.
Finally then, as our population grows and we design streets for the future, who should we have in mind?
I think there's no better frame than designing a street for kids, right? Having that perspective of a three-year-old. That totally changes how you look at the street. And, you know, making it safer for people to cross, making it more enjoyable for people to be around, I think that's the best lens for designing streets that work for everyone.
That's Jeanette Sadiq-Khan. She was in New Zealand this week for talks as a guest of the Helen Clark Foundation and the Urban Room. Hey, so you know, as well as watching our show on TVNZ Plus, you can also find all of our interviews on YouTube. Just search NZ Q&A and we will pop right up. Kua mutu. That is Q&A for this week. From the Q&A team, thank you for watching. Ngā mihi ki a koutou I ngā karere. Thank you for your feedback. Just so you know, we are off next weekend for the Easter break, but we are back the following Sunday from 9 a.m. So until then, kia pai te rangi nei. Have a good day. Q&A is made with the support of New Zealand On Air.